Economic progress is about making things better, but the issues that are really holding us back are often the ones that are hardest to fix.
One thing that's in common with both gender equality and the environment, sometimes economic progress helps them, and sometimes it doesn't help them. And so I think I was attracted to it as something where this is going to clash with economic development sometimes, and so how do you try to balance those?
Today we hear from an economist whose mission is to make sure that development means development for everyone.
I'm Seema Jayachandran. I am a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. You know, I think the criticism of how development economics is done today is that it's tackling smaller problems. And those might not, you know, show up as higher GDP in 4 or 5 years, but they're questions that are important and that are demonstrably improving the lives of millions of people.
Journalist Rhoda Metcalf sat down with Seema Jayachandran to discuss her work for our series about extraordinary women in economics.
So you've done some fascinating work in a variety of different areas, gender inequality, poverty, also the environment. What attracts you to a certain research project? What are the kinds of questions you're trying to answer?
Yeah, you know, development economics, which is the economics of low and middle income countries, is really broad. And I love that because it allows me to work on a broad array of topics. And I really think of development as having at least two parts. You know, one is the economic structures in low and middle income countries are different, and trying to understand what does that mean for what we should expect? You know, how might that influence policy? And then another part of it is really focused on a goal of reducing poverty, improving the well-being in developing countries where some of the poorest people in the world live. So I think I'm attracted to, you know, both those questions that are trying to understand the structure of the economy. That I think my nerdier side is drawn to those. And then I also have, especially over time, really come to appreciate the power, the opportunity to try to improve the lives of some of the least well-off people in the world. And so cases where I can see an opportunity to make a difference in policy attract me. I think one thing that's in common with both gender equality and the environment is they have pretty nuanced relationships with economic progress. Sometimes economic progress helps them, and sometimes it doesn't help them. And so understanding when it helps and when it hurts really means you need to think more smartly or broadly about policy.
So, you know, when it comes to improving the situation for women, especially in developing countries, you know, people often talk about changing laws and regulations, but a lot of your work is about shifting attitudes. Can you talk about why that's so important? And you know, and also tell us about the work you've done in this area.
Sure. That work on changing gender attitudes in India really came about from earlier work I had done where I had observed that some of the things that we think of as progress had been making some aspects of gender equality worse. So, for example, India has a really skewed sex ratio, meaning there are a lot more boys born than girls because parents want sons. So they have an ultrasound, find they're pregnant with a daughter and have an abortion. And in many ways, you know, that problem has gotten worse with progress. It's certainly gotten worse over time. You know, people have access to better technology, ultrasound. There's better access to safe abortion. And another kind of progress is people are able to have smaller families. You know, they have access to contraception. And for all of those reasons, you know, that's made the sex ratio worse.
And you did a study looking at this, right? Didn't you?
Yeah, exactly. And so what's the root of that problem? It's that people still really want to have a son, you know, even if there is access to savings and pensions. And so you don't really need your son to take care of you in old age financially. There's still a religious reasons and social status reasons why having a son is more valued than having a daughter. If that doesn't erode with economic progress, you're going to have these two things collide. And so that prompted me to say, okay, you know, can you change people's views so that they see the value of having daughters? And it's not just about the skewed sex ratio. It's about allowing girls opportunities to go to school, allowing women to work outside the home.
Right.
So we worked with a state government. They were interested specifically in this skewed sex ratio, but more broadly in improving gender equality. And you know, we kind of said, hey, are you willing to try something different of changing attitudes, just trying to get to the root of the problem? And, right. and as a pilot, they said, sure. So we worked with a nonprofit called Breakthrough, which developed a curriculum for students. So we said, okay, let's work with younger people where attitudes are more malleable. Let's work in schools because schools are a wonderful venue for changing attitudes. You know, governments, if they want to promote human rights or progress, they have this captive audience and can try to inculcate, you know, new views. The government allowed Breakthrough to run this class in government high schools in the state of Haryana for a couple of years, an hour every 2 to 3 weeks. And we as researchers evaluated, did this program change people's attitudes, you know, both right. immediately, and then did it stick with them? Did it persist?
Over time. And did you find that it was useful?
We did, yeah. It was useful, you know, and it really was a change in attitudes, and it translated into change behaviors. And I think the most remarkable thing, certainly what surprised me the most, is that it not only changed their attitudes immediately after this 2-year school program ended, but we went back to them 2 years later, and the changed attitudes had stuck with them. So we're very excited because right now we're going to try to keep measuring how it's affecting their lives as they're entering adulthood. So they're about 20 years old now. So we'll go back and see, you know, did the girls who had been in the program, are they more likely to finish college? Are they able to work outside the home? In a few years, you know, everyone will be married and we could see the boys who were in the program, are their wives more likely to be working than
right.
men who hadn't been in the program?
Right. So are you hoping to expand this program into other parts of India, for example?
Yeah, so this is we've had great success so far. So interestingly, in the state of Haryana, where we ran this study, there hasn't been take-up of the policy. So, you know, governments change.
Right.
But two states in India have decided to adopt this curriculum statewide. So the states of Odisha and Punjab are now rolling out this program to their students. There are, you know, thousands of schools and hundreds of thousands of kids who will now every year be taught this curriculum.
Wow.
So it'll take a while because the idea was to start with young people. But the hope is that in, you know, 10, 20 years, there'll be, you know, millions of people who will have a more progressive view on gender equality.
Well, that's really interesting. That must be very gratifying.
You know, there is something very special about concretely seeing that, you know, but for your research, there wouldn't be this curriculum in these schools and, you know, lives changed and hopefully making the world a better place.
Absolutely. One of the other projects that you've been involved with that I thought was really fascinating coming out of India was one where you were looking at the power of friendships and advancing women's entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about that project? I mean, how did you come up with the idea of focusing on women's friendships?
So this is a project that was thinking about business training for self-employed women.
Right.
You know, families don't want women to be working outside the home. So a lot of women, if they work, are doing some business at home, like maybe they're stitching clothes. And it's actually a trade union, SEVA, which is a very famous sort of group that works with women in Ahmedabad in the state of Gujarat. They had a bank and they give women microloans and they also try to give business training. You know, women don't have the networks that men have. They don't have as much formal education. And so it's a little crash course in some business skills.
Sure.
And we had this hypothesis that, you know, maybe one of the challenges is that some women aren't able to attend because, you know, their family won't even let them go and travel to the SEVA center for these classes. And so we thought, you know, what if we allow people to bring a friend? Then they'll might be more likely to attend. And there could be other reasons. You know, maybe you can reinforce the knowledge afterwards so you learn more. And so we tried kind of a comparison between two versions of the training, you know, the standard one and then the one where you can invite a friend. And the one where you can invite a friend worked much better. It's really the only one that made a difference to profits, et cetera. And it really seems to be that they set higher aspirations, you know, that part of the training is you set a goal and you think about, you know, how would you achieve the goal and, you know, take a loan to achieve it. And you could set modest goals or you could set ambitious goals. And we noticed that in the training, when you brought a friend, women set more ambitious goals. So it was, you know, it was this idea of like a, you know, cheerleader, a friend as a moral support, or, you know, championing you, being the one who pushes you harder. And again, you can imagine kind of harnessing that idea, catalyze these relationships so that women can encourage each other. You can imagine applying that in many other policies, you know, besides business training.
Yeah, very interesting. So you're a development economist. I mean, how do you think this field of economics is doing? I mean, there's still a lot of poor out there. Sometimes people wonder, well, you know, how much use is any of this kind of study? Do you think that development economics is becoming more successful at finding solutions?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I'm probably not the most objective person since I've chosen to, you know, work in this field, but you often hear, you know, people wanting us to come up with the answer for why are poor countries poor? You know, how do we make today's low-income countries richer? And I think that if you have too lofty an expectation, then the answer is no. You know, I don't think development economists have come up with the answer of, well, how can we make Africa grow at 20% over the next few decades? But I think that's the wrong expectation, you know, both of what to expect in the world, but also, you know, what research is able to do. And, you know, I think the criticism of how development economics is done today is that it's tackling smaller problems. It's saying, how do we try to create more opportunities for girls and women so that they can have more education? Or how do we improve the environment and protect forests in Uganda? And those might not, you know, show up as higher GDP in 4 or 5 years, but they're questions that are important, that are demonstrably improving the lives of millions of people, hundreds of thousands of people. And they're questions that we, you know, have the tools to answer and move the needle on policy. So I think they're amazing examples. You know, my soon-to-be colleague, Pascaline Dupas, she's done work on, you know, pricing of bed nets. And so this is often used as the example where people criticize development economics because it's like playing small ball. It's too small of a question. Should you give away bed nets to protect against malaria for free, or should you charge a small amount? And at the time, a lot of nonprofits were charging a small amount. And there were, you know, two arguments. One is if you pay a little, you feel guilty if you don't use it, so you're more likely to use it. And then another, which is a standard econ 101 idea, that if you charge a price, you know, the people who don't want it won't bother to pay the price. So you're kind of screening out the people who didn't want the bed net anyway. But Pascaline and co-authors, their work showed that by charging a little price, you lost a lot of people. Right. And they were the people who would have used it, needed it. They were just poor. And that research changed a lot of people's views. Major organizations started giving them away for free. More of the poor and needy were able to get bed nets, didn't have malaria, saved children's lives, improved people's health. You know, that's a really big accomplishment for research.
So I'm curious, what brought you to development economics? I mean, even in the broader, you know, field of economics, it's not the most high profile.
Yeah.
What happened in your life to draw you into this work?
Yeah, let me start with how I got to economics. You know, I was a latecomer to economics. I studied electrical engineering and physics in college, and maybe from the age of 19 to 27, I thought I was going to be a theoretical physicist. So I had started a PhD in theoretical physics, and, you know, I realized, okay, I don't want to be a theoretical physicist. And, you know, now it seems silly that I didn't realize this at the time, but I think I love taking physics classes. But, you know, as a professor, you're doing research, you're producing new knowledge in physics. And I just didn't like how I was spending my days. I was missing some of the balance of getting to write more or read more. And so I liked economics as like a triangulation of analytical, but also, you know, engaging with social problems.
Was that something that was on your radar when you were younger? I mean, the idea of poverty, social issues, is that something you've been really aware of from a young age?
Not really. You know, so my parents were born in India and, you know, immigrated, I guess, in the early 1960s to the U.S. And so, you know, obviously I had more exposure than many people to low-income countries because I went to India, you know, maybe 3 or 4 times as a kid. So, you know, certainly I'm sure that was in the back of my mind.
But I guess it must have been quite a contrast.
Yeah, right? Exactly. So subconsciously, but, you know, my college essay wasn't about how I want to commit my life to solving poverty in the U.S. or globally. And so I became interested in politics in high school and college. And so I think that's probably the link when I was thinking what part of economics sort of allows me to engage with some of the same questions I'm interested in as a political junkie. It was around these questions of, you know, reducing poverty or improving well-being. And actually in graduate school, I was had one foot in labor economics and one in development economics. And,
okay.
You know, I ended up my first year of the PhD, I took a development economics class with three people who then went on to win the Nobel Prize, Esther Duflo, wow. Michael Kremer, and Abhijit Banerjee. It was their first year teaching this class together. And so that class was just a very exciting class. And I thought, okay, I really like some of these questions and methods. And I'm happy for that historical accident because I think I appreciate more now than when I was in graduate school that, you know, the very poorest of the poor are in low and middle income countries. And so there is a really great need and a great opportunity to try to improve people's lives.
Now, some of your research has also tackled environmental issues.
Yeah.
Is that a longstanding interest for you?
I wasn't, you know, the crunchiest person, you know, beforehand. So I think some people who work on environmental protection, you know, that was their passion as a child. It wasn't for me. Again, I think I came at it because it's a problem that economic progress can make worse. So, you know, and I should say that, you know, most things in developing countries, you know, life expectancy is improving, education levels are improving, lots of things are improving rapidly. And like gender equality, it's more nuanced with the environment. I think I was attracted to it as something where this is going to clash with economic development sometimes. And so how do you try to balance those?
And you did an interesting project, right? It was in Africa. It was relating to protection of the local forest. Just tell me a little bit about that.
So that's it's really kind of thinking about, you want to take a global view to think about that project, which is where should we be mitigating carbon emissions? You know, we want to protect the environment. We're obviously in a very bad state in terms of climate change. And, you know, my own personal view is that rich countries should be funding most of that, you know. But there's still a question of where should you do that mitigation? And,
right.
You know, the beauty of climate change, you know, the one upside of it being a global externality, if we can reduce emissions in Uganda or Mexico, that's doing the same amount of good for the world as if we reduce them in the U.S. And you know, it turns out a lot of the least expensive ways to protect the environment and reduce carbon emissions are in low and middle income countries, you know, precisely because they're poor. So things are cheaper. Land is cheaper. Labor is cheaper.
Sure.
So that project was then saying, okay, how do we take that down to the ground level? How do we protect forests in a way that's not impoverishing people? If we say you can't cut trees, you know, someone was cutting those trees to sell them and pay for a hospital bill. And so you could flip that on its head and say, let's compensate people for protecting the forest. And so we did a study in Western Uganda trying out that idea. You know, can you cost effectively protect forests and therefore sequester carbon by compensating landowners, people who own forests, for keeping their forests intact? And it turns out that it's, you know, it's one of the cheapest ways to reduce carbon emissions. And the beauty of it is if it's a win-win, so that it's also creating biodiversity, which helps tourism in Uganda. It's having forests intact helps soil fertility and the water cycle. So those farmers are more productive. In that sense, it's a great opportunity.
Right. I know that in the past, you've written articles for the New York Times on various economic issues. How did you find that experience of taking economic ideas out to the wider public?
I loved it. That was great. It was a great opportunity to teach people some economics. I always had a goal of not just summarizing some evidence, but maybe people came away understanding a concept better. And also, I think the public that often doesn't realize the breadth of economics, you know, I'm sure almost everybody thinks economists are the ones who are thinking about inflation or the stock market. And, you know, obviously that's very far from what I work on. And so it was showing the breadth of what economists do.
Did you find it fairly easy to communicate these economic ideas in a simple way to a wider audience? Because, you know, I think a lot of economists are so used to writing in a very technical way and they have a hard time simplifying the ideas down to the point where your average person can understand what they're talking about.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, well, you know, what was nice is that was very clear that that was the constraint, right? So, you know, in some ways we have a luxury when we're talking to other economists that we can lean on jargon. You know, we don't have to try to say something in the clearest way. So, you know, sometimes it was hard, but it was a fun challenge. And, you know, I think, you know, probably one of my comparative advantages as an economist or as an academic is, you know, kind of clarity of thought. And I'm all at least aware when things are will be unclear to a broader audience. We also had a great editor, so he would remind me when something was still too opaque. But, you know, I think writing for a general audience, distilling what is the core idea, you know, thinking of analogies. So, you know, and those analogies could be helpful in your own research because you realize another application. And even if you didn't want your research to have any impact beyond academia, you know, it turns out to be a very valuable skill to, you know, be able to explain it clearly and strip away the jargon. And I think even more importantly, distill it to what are the core forces that are at work here, the core concept that matters.
Right, right. So what lies ahead for you? I mean, what are the questions you would like to research in the future?
At least for the near future, I'm going to continue to work on gender equality and environmental conservation. You know, one thing I've discovered is that, you know, as you work on projects, you get more ideas. But also in the research I am doing where you're working with partners, it also means you get more opportunities because somebody reads about your work and says, hey, do you want to work on this? And so, you know, that is a kind of increasing returns to working in one area. And so I'm very much interested in this idea of changing attitudes. And so I'm at the early stages of trying to develop some projects that work with much younger kids, you know, 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, what kind of scalable interventions could change very little kids' attitudes. And then also thinking about conservation. So a project I'm currently working on is thinking about not forests, but also farmers in North India burn residue after they grow crops. When you grow rice, it has stalk. People burn it because that's cheap. And so thinking about that same idea of compensating farmers so that if they clear that straw using farm equipment rather than burning it. And more of the same seems boring, but I think, you know, hopefully each study builds on the other, kind of expands knowledge, and, you know, is a new application that's hopefully valuable to the world.
That's great. Well, Seema Jayachandran, it's been such a pleasure speaking with you today. I think your work is really important, and I thank you for taking the time to talk to me about it.
Thanks a lot, Rhoda. It's my pleasure.
Seema Jayachandran is a professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. She also serves on the board of directors of the Abdul Latif Jameel Poverty Action Lab, or JPAL, as chair on gender. She was speaking with journalist Rhoda Metcalf. Look for other podcasts in our Women in Economics series on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, and subscribe if you like what you're hearing. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.